Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. How's everybody's summer going? I've pre-recorded this week's episode, so when you hear this, I'll be in Kennebunkport, Maine, not at Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick with our engineer, Dave Tatasciore. Dave, will you be on vacation as well?
You better believe it. I'm going to the Outer Banks.
The Outer Banks of?
That's North Carolina.
For anybody who wants to go visit Dave.
Don't bother.
Next week? No?
Don't call me. Don't email me. I'm gone.
Okay. I'll miss you. But I will be with my family.
I'll miss you too.
I'll be with my mom and all my siblings and nieces and nephews. We hang out up in, actually, it's Kennebunk, but it's like right outside Kennebunkport. I have lots of plans food-wise, as I would imagine you do. Chef Rebecca Charles is opening a Pearl Oyster Bar up there. I think it's open already, but I absolutely need to check that out. One of my favorite ice cream shops is up there, Rococo, which was founded by Lauren Guptill, who I had the pleasure of meeting last summer. Rococo always has really inventive flavors like Earl Grey, rosehip jam, and pistachio. That's one flavor. There's horchata rum cake, and of course, Maine whoopie pie. You can't go to Maine and not have that. Then we usually take a drive up to Portland to visit Lee Kellis's Holy Donut Shop. She makes the best donuts around, and her secret is, ready, Dave?
Ready.
Potatoes. Potatoes, yeah. I remember when I took my nephews there for the first time, they were little, and they could not understand why there were no potato chunks in their donuts. And I had to explain to them that it wasn't, you know, it was more like the mashed potato and you couldn't really taste it. But anyway, potatoes in the donuts. That's the secret up there in Maine. Do you have a lot of food plans, Dave?
I have one big food plan, which is to get all-you-can-eat crab legs because I can't find that in New York anywhere. I don't know why, but
all-you-can-eat isn't really a thing here in New York.
No. Yeah. Sadly. But yeah, down there they have Dirty Dick's Crab Shack, and I'm going to get all-you-can-eat crab legs, and it's going to be decadent and disgusting, and I'm going to love every minute of it.
There's a joke in there somewhere, but I'm going to try to keep this PG-13 right now and
just move on. Just going to blow right by it. Yep.
In other news, we're working on the Cherry Bomb Cookbook Tour. Our book is coming out October 10th. That's 10-10. Put it on your calendars. And it's available for pre-sale right now. We'll be announcing lots of special events and cookbook tour dates very soon. Dave, I told the team that if we make the New York Times bestseller list, I will dye my hair pink. Like, strip it and color it pale pink to match our cover.
Who do we know at the New York Times? can we get Russia to hack this? Russia, if you're listening.
Get Sam Sifton on the phone. I think each and every one of you listening right now would have to buy the book to make that happen, so no pressure. But you would have to cough up money too, Dave, to buy it for us to make the New York Times bestseller list.
I'll check in the couch cushions out here.
Seriously, though, it's a beautiful book, and the whole team is really proud of it. It features 100 of the most interesting and creative women in food, and they each gave us a recipe they love. I can't wait for all of you to see the finished product. You too, Dave.
I can't wait.
So let's thank our sponsors. Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school, has locations around the globe from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from 9-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. And for those of you wondering, we did pick a winner for our Le Cordon Bleu sweepstakes. Keep an eye on our Instagram for the big reveal. And thank you to Castor and Pollux, the maker of America's number one organic pet food, and the company behind the brand new line of purposeful pet food called Pristine. What does purposeful pet food mean exactly? It means Castor and Pollux uses only the most responsibly sourced ingredients to create the most nutritious recipes for your pet's health. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. Don't forget to tag pictures of your dog with hashtag CherryBombPets. And you could win a year's supply of Pristine. We love looking at your photos, so thank you to everyone who has tagged us so far. Today's guest is Aura Wise, the head chef of Harvest and Revel, a very mindful private events catering and pop-up company in Brooklyn. Aura has spent the past 16 years doing community education and organizing around social justice and food issues. It's my pleasure to welcome Aura to Radio Cherry Bomb. Please enjoy our interview. You are a Radio Cherry Bomb and Heritage Radio Network virgin, basically, right?
Yes.
You are maiden voyage with us here, so welcome.
Thank you. I can't wait to have my cherry popped.
That's a good one. I don't think anyone has said that yet.
I figured that I was going to have to do that thing that everybody does when they say to me, oh, I can feel your aura, where they're like saying it and they know they shouldn't say it because I've heard it 4,000 times. So I thought that was going to be the case right now.
You know what? That didn't even cross my mind. But it is such a great name, and it's spelled O-R-A. How'd you wind up with the name Aura? And your last name is perfect too, Aura Wise. I mean, it's such a great name.
I have a big persona I need to fill, or legacy. My parents are Jewish hippies, who also incidentally taught me everything I know about food, or at least built the foundation. But yeah, my father's a rabbi, my mother's an artist and a storyteller, and Aura means light. My full name, just so you get the full package, is Aura Ruach Wise, which means light spirit wise.
Wow. But now that I think about like Aura Wise, it's such, if people don't know you and they just met you, they would probably expect you to be this very sort of like Zen wise human being. And I don't, we've just become acquainted over the past few months. So yeah. I don't know you that well, but are you sort of this Zen wise, tranquil person in real life?
I try to tap into the wisdom that all the amazing people in my life let me cull from them. Zen, I'm not sure I would really use to describe me. I'm maybe more on the energized side. Although since I became a chef, which was actually only about 5 years ago, I, for the first time in my life, started valuing stillness, meditation, which I suck at, but at least I value the attempt. You know, breathing. I think I never, in my youth, I undervalued stillness and quiet. And now I definitely value it more, although I wouldn't say that's my forte.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm trying. Now I value it, definitely. And I think I did when I was younger too, because I am one of five children.
Oh wow.
So I did always like finding some quiet and some peace. I loved as a kid just going off and riding my bicycle by myself. Mm. And I recently just started doing that again. I got a city bike membership.
Yay.
And I take out my city bike and ride along Brooklyn Bridge Park, which if you live in Brooklyn and you have not, or the whole city, and you haven't checked out the park yet, it's so beautiful. And it's, there's everything you need. Did you know there's a roller skating rink there?
Yeah, there's everything. And the skyline looks like a graphic novel.
Oh my gosh.
I just love on the days when it's like the bright blue sky and those picture perfect clouds, I feel kind of like everyone is just being dosed with LSD. Like it's like you, if you walk or ride along Brooklyn Bridge Park and you're looking at the skyline and it looks animated and everything, you're like, wow, it's just like free drugs for everyone. We live in this amazing, magical metropolis.
That didn't cross my mind, but I do appreciate the skyline in other ways. And the landscaping is beautiful. If you go in the morning and ride your bike, walk, push your stroller, whatever, it's a really lovely experience. If you go on a really nice weekend
with tourists,
oh, not just tourists, I mean, that is a loved and utilized park.
Yes,
it is crazy. It is packed, and good luck riding a bicycle.
True.
It's like walking across,
it's like the Brooklyn Bridge.
I was just going to say that if you've ever tried to ride a bicycle across the Brooklyn Bridge,
don't do it. It's more romantic
luck.
In theory.
Yes, but it's a beautiful walk
for sure.
But you know what the bridge to ride your bike over is? The Manhattan Bridge.
I haven't done that.
You feel like you're in a Scorsese movie.
Mm,
because
I love
it's
that.
The opposite of romantic and picture
right.
perfect.
The grit.
It's so gritty.
We need to preserve more of the grit of New York. We're getting too glossy.
The Manhattan Bridge bike path ain't glossy. You've got graffiti, garbage, chain link fence. It's the real deal.
All right. If I ever, I actually have never ridden a bike. Once I got a city bike and rode it in Manhattan. I got hit by a car years ago.
Oh, no.
And pretty badly. It actually was a hit and run, and there was a high speed chase with the police, and the guy who hit me sideswiped two other cars.
Oh, boy.
It was pretty wild, but I ended up broken. It took me a while to get back on a bike.
I understand that.
But it's a joy machine. I can't stay off of it. I just tend to be a little bit more timid when it comes to Manhattan.
Well, I'm glad you survived all that and are here to tell us your story. You dropped in a little bit earlier that you've only been a chef for 5 years. I did not know that.
Yeah.
How did that all come to be?
Well, food has always been at the center of my life. I was born in Jerusalem and raised vegetarian, which of course, at that time, which is funny to say, I don't think of myself as so old, but, you know, my parents were both vegetarian since they were in their teens or early 20s. And so it was before that was more widely popular in the U.S. So it took a lot of intention. We always had a big garden, composted, and then also we were back and forth during my childhood between the Midwest and the Mideast, kind of, a little bit. And so I was really, really shaped by the foods of the Mediterranean. Also, my grandfather is Italian, and though I never knew him, my mother's heritage really influenced our food. And we hosted Shabbat Sabbath dinners every single Friday. So I literally came up hosting and gathering around food and food as ritual and food as holiday. I mean, the joke around Jewish holidays is every single holiday, the story is the same. They tried to kill us. They didn't. Let's eat. And
that really condenses it down, huh?
Yeah. So it's always been at the center, part of the fabric of my life. But as I was telling you briefly before, I actually spent most of my life until a few years ago as a community educator and organizer. I did a lot of organizing with youth organizations in Palestinian refugee camps in the West Bank, and then also running after-school programs using art and media to do leadership development in Black, Latino, and Indigenous youth groups, as well as within my own community and Jewish education programs, and connecting them. So using magazines and hip-hop videos that then got translated between Spanish and Arabic and English and Arabic so that the youth in Palestine and here could talk to each other. And we actually brought delegations of media workers and organizers to Palestine from we did an indigenous youth delegation, and we did a delegation of artists from Detroit to Palestine. And it was important work, and it was inspiring and rewarding, and also it was demoralizing. And I realized at a certain point that I was burned out and that no project or community is well served by a tired and uninspired leader or facilitator. So, and all this work I was doing was with creatives, with musicians and filmmakers. I helped produce Slingshot Hip Hop, which is a film about the Palestinian hip hop movement that debuted at Sundance Film Festival in 2008. And so it was so amazing, and I learned a lot, but I realized I wasn't being the creator that I needed to be. And food was my creative work. It's always been my art and the way that I learned the world and celebrated the world and took care of people around me. So I made a funny decision to, feeling burned out, then enter one of the most exhausting lines of work. But what I realized later is that I was actually just, I recently got back from Detroit, where we produced the Food Matters track at the Allied Media Conference, which is a over 2,000 person annual gathering in Detroit of people using art, media, and technology to work towards a more just and creative world. And we worked with Chef Chinchakria Un of Krung, Cambodia here, and Earthworks Urban Farm in Detroit to produce a 250 person outdoor community dinner.
Wow.
And how that is relevant is, one, the point was always for me to learn more about the systems involved in food, and then come figure out ways to return to participating more actively in movements for self-determination, because we know food is so central to that. And so two things. One is that I was just reading, I got in Detroit from a compañera and dear friend of mine, Adrienne Marie Brown. A book of hers just came out called Emergent Strategy, and she talks about being a pleasure activist and how, and she names something that's always been central to the way that I've done work for social justice, which is that shame and even just facts about how messed up things are. I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss, but I just censored myself.
Yes.
Okay, great. How fucked this shit is. Facts about it, shame about it, are not actually that great motivators for change. And actually, pleasure can open us up and can inspire and can help make people feel that more is possible. So food and hospitality and gathering with the beauty and sensuality, which was always central in my family. You know, my mother always had seasonal flower bouquets and the linens, and the setting of the table was even such a big part of it. So that obviously is a reason why starting to work in the food world professionally or more full time felt strategically important and allowed me to have the centrality and creativity in myself, or develop that. And then the other thing is that when I was in Palestine, I spent one summer with a group of international activists doing human rights observation work in Jayus, which is a little farming village of a little over 1,000 Palestinian farmers. And the apartheid wall that Israel had built was built between them and their farmland. So they had to ask permission from these Israeli soldiers every day to get to their farmland and back. And so sometimes they just, on somebody's whim, some 18-year-old boy with a racist education and a big gun, determine whether they could harvest their mangoes. Or I was there during mango season. Oh my God. And also the soldiers at night, when they were just feeling feisty, would go through and shoot holes in their water tanks. So this was like an example of how like food and growing food and access to food is so central to colonial systems. And have also, of course, always been so central to movements for self-determination, from, you know, the Black Panthers breakfast programs in Harlem or Ella Baker's land trust in the South. So for me, realizing that Palestinians used to be a mainly agrarian society and got removed from their land and are in refugee camps that really mirror in a lot of ways what we call food deserts, or Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm upstate calls a food apartheid zone, essentially, because deserts are natural. And the way that our cities are structured is the direct result of racism. So realizing bodegas and what's available there so much echoed, I was seeing the same thing in these stores in Palestinian refugee camps, because their fresh produce wasn't being allowed, literally was being blocked. And the only products they could buy were processed food products from European and Israeli companies. And I was like, wait, food is literally being used. It's not coincidental. It's being used to keep people down.
So you mentioned you moved away from your activism because you were demoralized. Was that all what led to that?
Yeah, I think I felt a little heartbroken, and I needed to do some re-energizing.
Heartbroken because you just felt that no matter what you did, you couldn't make a difference because this problem was so colossal?
You know, that's a good question. You know, often more than anything else, the dysfunction in our own house hurts most. And although I was a part, it just takes its toll on people to be literally fighting for their lives all the time, or fighting for change, you know, so intensely all the time for free in your spare time, of which you have none, and, you know, with your full body and spirit. And so I think that I was just feeling depleted. By confronting ignorant people in my own community, confronting soldiers, dealing with under-resourced nonprofits that then like sometimes weren't organizing things in a way that felt most productive or positive, you know, those kinds of things. And so, and also I think because I was doing, like I said, so much work to try to uplift other people's creative work and put their work to work, I'm doing air quotes, I realized that what I needed was to tap into to my creative work and my creative self and then have more of me to give again to in a collective sense after I did some sorting out.
So you decide to become a chef.
Yeah.
Crazy. How do you just break into the chef world at that age? I mean, you weren't a kid, you know.
Yeah. Then, you know, I'm sure that I know that the stories I've heard from others are all, different. Mine might be particularly, unconventional, but I want to name that actually for me as a woman in my 30s, changing careers seriously. Like, obviously, like I said, food, I knew food to some extent. Preparing lots of food was not the problem, but learning the systems and the industry and the pressures and all of it, to change careers in my, at that time, like kind of early 30s, was really a lot scarier and sadder than I thought it would be. I had the strategic plan. You know, I said, I have a compass rather than a detailed roadmap. I know that my goal is to eventually like come back into, like I said, like, you know, decolonization movements, with a focus on food systems and all these things. And so there's going to be some time I need to just learn. And it was so much harder to be patient with myself in that during that and feel like all my peers were actually just advancing in the work they were doing because they'd been doing it for a decade or more. And I just left the work that I had become an expert in. So that, just to name for everyone out there who's thinking of doing it, just anticipate that. Also financially, you will be a mess.
Were you here in New York?
Yeah. So it was a little bit funny of a, I was, but it involved a trip down south.
We'll take a break for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Aura Wise of Harvest and Revel.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine. And from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donna Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made with ingredients like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do. And as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
Welcome back. Let's return to Aura and her trip down south.
So my partner, father had property in Rosemary Beach, Florida, which is in what they call the Redneck Riviera, on the Gulf of Mexico in the panhandle of Florida. The last place that my queer Jewish ass would have thought I would be launching my culinary career. And his father, my partner, was going down to open a beachside cafe with his father. And his father had what had been a New Orleans style snowball shop, like this little tiny shop with like window service to this little courtyard in this tiny town that is like a resort. It's not a town. It's a fancy giant mansion town on the beach. And he said, do you want to do shaved ice? And I said, no, I don't do pastry, you know, or whatever. I'm the, all the other people in my life do that. I've always, I'm like the savory cook person. And then I was like, okay, I can make popsicles. So I opened a shaved ice and popsicle stand in a former New Orleans style snowball shop in the panhandle of Florida. And it was actually so much more enjoyable and rewarding than I thought it would be.
You got to make people happy all day long.
I got to make people happy. I got to teach them what real fruit was. When I got into his mother, my partner's mother and I, cleaned out the shop, and it was filled with those jugs of the syrup that they, and it was like wedding cake and blue raspberry and all these things. So like, it's so sticky. And so we got it all
out.
Wait,
those aren't all naturally flavored and naturally colored?
Not yet. Not yet. They're working on it. But then it was a real struggle in Florida, which is a hot mess in lots of ways, to find like no spray, at least, or organic producers. But I found them. I found this awesome Tupelo honey guy and this peach guy and blueberry guy. So, and like to do things that were seasonal, which were also wild for me because in May watermelon was in season and peaches. But so then I would have kids come up and be like, they're like, I don't know what I want. I'm like, well, what's your favorite fruit? And they'd be like, red. And I'd be like, okay, well, nothing here is like really, really red. The watermelon is delicious and pinkish. And then they would love it. They'd be like, it tastes like real watermelon. And I'd be like, it is.
All right. So this is so far away from like your Palestinian activism, but since it's summer, give us a popsicle making tip, since you obviously, you know, had a lot of experience doing it that summer.
Yeah. And
how do you,
I just
how do you make
did
a
them
great
again.
Popsicle.
Well, I am certainly not, I only did it for a season and then we just started experimenting with doing it here. So at our new Caribbean pop-up Kit and Kin, I did a pineapple basil lime pops.
Do you just throw everything in a blender?
Yep.
And whiz it up and then,
yep, freeze it.
What's a great popsicle mold? There's so many out there. What's,
oh yeah,
what's
what
like
are
a
the
good,
ones
legit one?
I can't remember the name. I'll have to
but
tell you, and you
okay.
can put them in the
we'll,
links.
We'll that, put it on,
yeah,
Instagram.
I mean, and there's a lot of it, there's a lot of different things. Like if you're gonna be legit, then you want to blast freeze things and everything, because different substances freeze at, if it doesn't freeze fast enough, then things can separate and stuff. I actually had, when I was doing this, read the People's Pops cookbook, and they made a good recommendation for a business person owner like me, which was, don't invest in that kind of level of equipment until you're really rocking. Just make it work with what you have. So I now have in the basement of my building here in Brooklyn 500 popsicle molds. So if anyone wants to talk to me,
if you need to make some popsicles, you
but
know
I would
to call
say
me.
My right. But my tip is, for me, I like creamy pops. I'm not as into icy pops. So even with that pineapple basil one, the pineapple, when you puree it, is kind of creamy. My favorites, people's favorites, where I did a key lime pie pop, which was dipped in chocolate and then dusted in graham cracker. And then I did a PB&J pop. That was cool. This line cook in a restaurant in Rosemary Beach was foraging dewberries, which are basically like a southern blackberry. And I would macerate them and puree them. And then I made a peanut butter cream and I swirled them together.
Ooh.
I would highly, that would be my popsicle tip. Make PB&J pops.
You just reminded me, I think I used to make popsicles when I was a kid, but we would take like those waxy Dixie cups,
yep,
and make popsicles out of chocolate milk.
Yeah.
And orange juice.
It's like the lazy man's ice cream.
Exactly.
Of.
Or little kid, yeah, you know, little kid popsicles.
Right. That's right. I shouldn't be judgmental.
We probably like stuck a spoon in it or something. I don't even know what we would have used as sticks.
Which is great, since you and I were just talking about how we want to reduce disposables.
We were, you know, we should talk about that a little bit, because it's summertime and it's so easy. You know, everybody's outside and you're getting all this stuff to go. And I'm really trying hard. You've all heard me talk about my brother. He's sort of like the anti-plastics dude for Surf Rider New York, and has really been getting me and my family to reduce our plastic consumption. And it's, you know, it takes some work. It's not easy, but it's super doable. And I went to, do you know Lauren, who does the blog Trashes for Tossers?
Oh, yeah.
She just opened that shop in Williamsburg.
Oh, wow.
Is it called Package Free or Zero Waste? I'm blanking, but it's one of those names. But it's fantastic, and everything is geared toward having a life where you produce as little garbage as possible. And so I got some like small reusable wooden utensils that come in a little case that you can bring on airplanes and bring to picnics. And, you know, it's really just changing your own behavior, because you go and you get ice cream, you know, don't get that plastic spoon, bring your own spoon. You might feel a little weird, but you'll get over it, and no one's looking at you or judging you. You know, same with straws. You know, those glass Dharma straws are so great. Have you ever used those?
No, but I do love straws, so I need to get one.
Exactly. So, and I don't like a metal straw.
No.
These are glass, and they're fantastic, and they come with like a little pipe cleaner thing, so you can keep them clean.
Oh, that's awesome.
What else did I buy at Lauren's? A water bottle. I just could not find a good water bottle. So I got this one. It's glass, and it has sort of this black rubberized thing on the outside, and I was about to head to Los Angeles and San Francisco, and I brought it with me, and I filled it at the airport.
Yeah.
And when you just think about all the waste in the airports, because they've really done a number on everybody, and you think you can't bring your own food, you can't bring your own water, you can't bring utensils, but you can.
Yeah.
You know, and I forget when I was talking about this last, but Alice Waters, I can't remember if it was when Alice was on the show or something in the magazine, but Alice talked about how she brings her own food to airports.
I do too.
And you know what?
I don't know. A full picnic every
and
time.
It never crossed my mind for some reason. I think because you just
no
feel...
No purees, though.
Right, right. I've gotten things...
I argued with...
I got a really sexy almond butter confiscated at the airport once, and I tried to argue that it wasn't a liquid.
Man, we were flying back as a family from Italy when they imposed this. It was that, like, the next day after the whole thing that happened that made them do this. And my mother had all this acacia honey from Tuscany. Aww. It was so sad, and they took it. I once successfully convinced a guy to let me through with hummus, though, because every time he said, don't count on it, though. I just was, like, bullying enough. I was like, no, it's just hummus. And he was like, well, it's like a liquidy, creamy thing. I was like, no, it's not. It's hummus. And I just kept saying that until he let me through.
But anyway, it's you know, start with baby steps. And it's also when you go to the supermarket, like, just start to look at what is in single-use plastic packaging versus what's in something you can recycle versus what's in glass.
Well, I feel like, and I'm glad that you're talking about this, because one of the things I think we have become somewhat better at about as an industry and also as a society is thinking a bit more, we have a long way to go, about where our food comes from. But the much less sexy aspect of the cycle of food is where it goes, where waste goes, the other end, right, of the circle. First of all, we don't think in circles, we think in lines. So it just like we get it and then we, you know, it just goes somewhere. But it actually, if we were to embrace the fact that we are a part of nature and we work in the same ways, which is everything is a cycle, it would be easier for us to kind of feel that literally cringiness when we like throw a plastic bottle away. But
I'm starting to feel that.
And once you pay attention, then you do. So
you can also carry things home and recycle them at home, which I'm getting better at.
Yeah. And people are just they feel so entitled to like not having to put effort into things, you know, like
you said something important earlier, though, when we were off air, you said we have to do better, but we also have to acknowledge that we're imperfect. And I think sometimes it's just so hard. It's easier not to
try it all.
Or you do want to be perfect. You're like, I want to have that zero waste lifestyle and just be perfect, but you'll pretty much never be.
Yeah.
So I mean, don't not try.
Right.
Because of that.
We're all in this system. So it's like, you have to choose your battles, but keep choosing more and more all the time. And then also kind of to understand that just like the paradoxical nature of most of our lives, you know, I feel like I help coordinate myself and several other folks coordinate a group called FIG, Food Issues Group. And we're an informal collective, basically a study towards action group of chefs and growers and distributors and food media makers, people working in food, who gather about every 2 months to study different issues of sustainability and use ourselves as case studies, like our own businesses and our own projects as case studies, and try to figure out together different small to, you know, micro to macro ideas for changing things. And so we had a couple of sessions on food waste, and it was one of the more daunting conversations. So we start, you know, learned a bit about, we had Allison from Rivertown Compost Foundation come and talk to us. It was almost like she was speaking another language, because it's so complex. But I feel like the thing is for us to just start, and I see this with my clients all the time. We have to literally include in our like documents with them when like someone is booking us to cater an event for them, do you have a plan for trash? Because they don't think about it. And that says a lot. But then those of us who are trying, oh, I brought this up because you're saying, or we're saying together, you know, we have to do better and we're imperfect.
Right. And I confessed to you that I was kind of embarrassed that we didn't do better at our Jubilee conference. Like it was not as green as it should have been,
right?
Could have been,
right?
And we will do way better the next time,
right? And then that's the thing, is we're taking on a lot, right? And so we have to figure out like moving forward. And also, there's kind of an idea of saying we're going to go instead of a mile wide and an inch deep, to go a mile deep and an inch wide. And that kind of informs for me, like sometimes that helps me figure, like, not, you know, figure out how to embrace the imperfections a little bit and be like, okay, right now I'm really focusing on empowering young women of color in my company. And so I am cringing when I throw this vegetable peel into this garbage can, because last week I figured out a dish that allowed me to repurpose that, but this week I am crazy and I can't do it. And the carting systems all make you pay for composting and they don't actually compost them, and it's all a mess. So I'm going to throw this in the garbage, but I am working to launch this Caribbean pop-up in the vision and leadership of my young Trinidadian and Jamaican chef with her family to like redistribute power and resources. So
you just got a lot into that sentence, boy. I got to hand it to you. I just decided what our new motto is, Aura.
Uh-oh. We have, like, yours
you
and
I. Yes. Think small.
Right.
Because you can get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Just, you know, there's just so much going on in the world right now, but I'm going to hashtag think small.
Think small and try.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, we have a million things we can talk to you about, and we are going to run out of time, so I just want to, two things I definitely want to talk about. Another thing you mentioned off, I was going to say camera, but no, off mic.
That's next.
Off mic was, you said being a chef has forced you to be really organized. And I struggle with organization. I'm sure a lot of our listeners do. Can you just talk a little bit about how it's sort of rewired your brain and just some advice and how you stay organized?
Yeah, I would say, well, I think what I said is I'm trying to
try
that it's an epic. No, I've always been a multitasker, and this is really pushing me to my limit. Yeah, I mean, with running any kind of food operation, we were just talking about, you have to think about staffing, and you have to think about waste, and you have to think about sourcing, and then you have to think about, for me, I'm very, very serious and uncompromising about my sourcing. So that means that I have some pretty intense constraints on my ordering, because this farm or this small distributor from these farms only, I have to order by this time and it gets delivered at that time, and I have to meet a minimum because they couldn't afford to deliver if it weren't that. So for me, I've had to develop a better ability to plan ahead, be able to say, today I have to order for something that's happening next week so that it arrives in the time that we can process it before then. And it is, you know, so just organizing schedules and thinking ahead and checking in with calendar systems. We have so many shared calendars for the, because we cook in a shared kitchen. So we have 3 million calendars overlapping. You have to think about how it, you know, I have to think about how any changes in my schedule might affect another team that's cooking in the kitchen and vice versa. But I think more than anything else, it's made me more organized while I'm actually cooking. Like, you have to, and that's the thing I lamented the most when I was on not having professional training, was that there's just certain, like, systems and tools of, like, efficiency and organization.
You're talking about, like, mise en place?
Yeah, mise en place and figuring out how to focus on a task and get it done and clean it up and get that out of the way and what to do first and everything. And so I've become way better at, you know, prioritizing and, a process and what comes first and making sure that I clean as I go, which was not always my forte.
That's not my forte. Has this crossed over into your real life, IRL?
So amusingly, just today, so I live with my partner and another dear friend, and just today we had a little process around the kitchen situation being like, okay, you have done so good. You're so much better at cleaning the island after you cook, but we also need to keep all the dry goods, not like I'm like stuffing bags of things in all the corners of seeds and nuts and new spices I just got. So I'm evolving. I'm definitely better at cleaning while I cook and need to figure out better taking the time to keep the bigger systems in order. It's all about systems.
We're all imperfect. All right. And then a few minutes. I can't believe we only have a few minutes to let you talk about Harvest and Revel, but a few minutes. Yes. Dave just gave me the 3-minute sign.
3 minutes. That's
so quickly, what is Harvest and Revel and how can people work with you?
Okay.
At Harvest and Revel.
So Harvest and Revel is led by Sarah Elise, who's the owner and designer, and myself and our magical being, sous chef Anya. And we, like I said, cook in a shared kitchen in Crown Heights. And we, how people can work with us is go to harvestandrevel.com and see we have some sample menus. There'll be some summer menus up there. And we have sample menus and examples of our work. We do our best. We are as flexible as possible to work with the widest range of people as possible. If somebody, like we've done a lot of work either, you know, at cost or donated for different youth media organizations, we work with the Feast Youth Cooking Leadership Program at Northeast Brooklyn Housing Development Corporation in Bed-Stuy. And then also we do big fancy weddings like art gallery, like plated dinners. And so for us, I mean, our kindred spirit clients are people in the creative fields. People who value color and flavor, not only in the food, but in the people who are serving them. You know, we're like a funky, wild bunch. But we're also like incredibly into the elegance and ritual of food. So yeah, people should hit us up. Also Harvest and Revel on Instagram and our new Caribbean pop-up, which will probably at different points be at Cafe Erzuli here in Bushwick. We consult and do the menu for and provide some of the like pickles and preserves and stuff for Cafe Erzuli, which is a Haitian inspired, part Haitian owned cafe. And our pop up is Kit and Kin, KITANKIN. So, yeah, those are all the ways to find us.
So if you are a mindful human being looking for a mindful catering company, you know who to check out. That's it for today's show. Thank you to Aura Wise for joining us in the studio. And thank you to our engineer, Dave Tadashore. Dave, have a fantastic vacation. You really deserve it.
Oh, thanks, Carrie. You too.
Thanks. And thank you to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you're a devoted pet parent, check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. And thank you to Le Cordon Bleu. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary culinary school. And don't forget, you can pre-order the Cherry Bomb Cookbook on Amazon, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble, or from your favorite indie bookstore, like Books or Magic right here in Brooklyn or Book Soup in Los Angeles. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Becky Hughes. I am a writer at Epicurious. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Sarah Franklin. She is an incredible journalist, and she's a food studies professor at NYU. She is one of the most thoughtful, creative, and supportive women I've ever met, and she taught me everything I know about food theory.